This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The North Carolina coastline provides an ideal habitat for growing oysters. The brackish estuaries and sounds are home to both wild oyster communities and cultivated farms. Yet the North Carolina oyster industry has lagged behind that of other states. When Ryan Bethay learned this, he saw an opportunity. A love for all things North Carolina and the pull of working on the water led Ryan to oyster farming. Now his company, Oysters Carolina, is in its fifth year, and Ryan joins us now on the State of Things. Ryan Bethay, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for having me.
I've never talked to an oyster farmer before, so what's a typical day like on the oyster farm?
On the oyster farm, we are kind of governed by weather and tides. So our oyster farm is intertidal, which means, typically two times a day, sometimes just once, we get a low tide. So the tide ebbs out and exposes our oysters and our oyster cages, and it makes it a lot easier to work. Tide is one of those things that it's not the end-all be-all, but it really helps, really makes our job a lot easier if we can go out there and work at the low tide. The other issue is wind. So wind kind of mixed with the weather is our really kind of a driving factor for what we can get done out there.
How big an area are we talking about here?
Well, we're fortunate. We were able to lease 5 1/4 acre from the state. So it's a nice size patch of water. And the way it works is North Carolina, in our state, the waters are a public trust. So actually every North Carolina citizen, everybody that's listening right now, actually owns our water. And then we lease it from the state, and we're able to work it and grow oysters. And people are still able to come by and look and see what we do and kayak through there and fish and all that good stuff.
And so what makes North Carolina, the coast, so good for oysters?
Well, North Carolina, right, I think North Carolina is the greatest state in the country, just being from here. But what makes our kind of the coast ideal for doing this stuff is it's just so pristine. Most other states, not to talk trash about Virginia or, some states in the Gulf or kind of in the New England area. But they have a lot of infrastructure on their coast. They have a lot of industry. There's refineries. There's kind of just a whole world that's kind of built up on their coast. In North Carolina, you might know that all we have is pretty much houses. In the southern part of the state, there's a little bit more industry down there. But once you get north of Wilmington, it's kind of far out there. It's rural area, and it's nothing but nice land, clean water, and houses.
Well, what about upstream? The upstream that feeds into, and kind of what's the blend in terms of the water quality of coastal water clarity, coastal water purity, and that which comes to you from the rivers?
Well, we're really fortunate because we're what people would call down east, which is just a great area of the state. And we're in the White Oak River Basin, so we really have a pretty small river basin. The only thing that we're really dealing with is wild animal coliform. That's really the only thing, the fecal matter from wild animals. That's really the only thing that we deal with at our farm. And, it's just... upstream, I think there's a lot of issues, and I think other areas in the country and in the state deal with, CAFOs and Gen X and things like that. But where we are, we're really fortunate that our water is just really clean and pristine.
Well, tell us how you happened to find out about oyster farming, because that was an interesting that ordeal itself, that by chance you opened up a magazine
right.
And learned about farming in North Carolina. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. I come home one night and there was a state, like a Farm Bureau magazine, just kind of a normal publication that most people just throw away. Mm-hmm. And it was actually turned to an article about oyster farming in North Carolina. And somebody reached out to, I think the gentleman's name is Jay Styron. He's kind of like the grandfather of North Carolina oyster farming. And he had been trying to get the industry off the ground. This is back in 2009, 2010, 11. And, they just had an article talked about how our state is just really poised for this industry to take off, and we just weren't doing it. There was no one that was really interested in kind of going into it. And then I read it, and it just kind of hit me. You know, I even had a hard time sleeping that night. It was something I kind of felt like it would be, you know, it's kind of what I was here to do.
Well, then if you decide that and you actually lose a night's sleep over it, I guess the next thing you have to do is figure out how you're going to learn to do this. What did you do to educate yourself?
Yeah. So, you know, again, this is 9-10 years ago, and you know, anything that's worth it seems to take some time. So I did that. I went back to school, got a degree in geography. And that gave me a lot of tools that I needed that I use, you know, daily out on the oyster farm. And after I graduated with a degree in geography, I was able to get accepted into a kind of a certificate postgrad type program with William and Mary at a place called the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. And it was in oyster genetics and aquaculture. So it's a small program that only hosted 4 people a year. And once I was accepted into that, I was able to kind of get a technical background, which I think is important really for anything, especially that you're going to devote your life to. I think it was good to get a technical background and then got started.
You know, this is kind of a side note, but you said you got a degree in geography, and that was, of course, North Carolina Central. You went to North Carolina Central for that, and you got your degree in geography.
Program.
Few people think about getting a degree in geography. How did you think that of all things, because the marine aquaculture, that makes perfect sense to me, but geography, right. And you said it's important. How so?
Yeah. Well, you know, people think that geography is going to be looking at maps.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to say, that's something I do enjoy. But it's probably one of the least interesting or, you know, not very interesting thing about me. But, you know, what you spend a lot of time doing is taking oceanography classes and working with GIS and geography and geology and things like that, weather. You know, North Carolina weather was one of my favorite classes I took. And, you know, I deal with weather, constantly checking the weather, whether you're out there or deciding to go out there or just kind of planning the week. And, you know, the geography of our farm, just the geomorphology of underwater and the currents and what to expect, all that stuff helps us grow oysters. And, you know, without that program, without that knowledge, I'd be even more lost than I am some days out there.
So that's their environment. And again, getting the big picture about that environment was important to you. And then the biology, you know, until I started doing the research on this and reading about you, I never really thought about oyster reproduction. Fairly interesting stuff. I mean, give me a sense of, because you're cultivating them, right? And so it's not like, how do you breed them? They have two sets of chromosomes. This seems like a dicey proposition, trying to get the right oyster in the next generation.
They do. And, you know, we can really kind of dive into this, but just a brief overview of it is, you know, oysters, they're colony animals. So you normally find oysters all together, kind of growing on top of each other. And within that oyster reef, right, is what it's called. Some of the oysters are males, some of the oysters are females, and actually a small percent, about 15%, are hermaphroditic. So what happens is when the water reaches a certain temp, and the oysters are a certain age, they actually shoot out their gonad. So they might shoot out some sperm or shoot out egg. And that is just in the water, kind of floating around at the mercy of tides and wind and all kinds of other things. And hopefully the sperm and the egg meet and mitosis starts happening, and that turns into larvae. The larvae then swims around. It goes through several different stages. Some call D stage, then it goes through Velliger stage, then a petty Velliger stage. The oyster actually has an eye at one point during its kind of larval time, and then it goes around, it's swimming around, it's trying to find some hard substrate to land on, and once it finds something that's suitable, it lands on that, and it starts kind of converting more energy into growing calcium carbonate, which is what the shell is made out of, and it becomes sessile. So it stops moving, it latches, kind of attaches onto something, and then grows into the oysters that we see today.
That's pretty fascinating stuff, if you ask me. And, yeah. And I wonder, I don't have too much time in this, do they travel far in those larval states, or do they pretty much stay close to home if they
hook on? It's something that we don't know a lot about, Frank, but we do know that this year we're having a lot of setting. So when the oyster attaches to some hard substrate, that's called setting. And for whatever reason this year, I think it's because of all the work that lots of people have been doing trying to get more oysters in the water to breed. We're having a lot of wild strike, which is just when the baby oysters set and they start to grow. They cover everything. So they cover boats, they cover pilings, they cover all of our cages and bags, and even the oysters that we're trying to sell. If you buy oysters from us, you'll see some of that. Wow. Strike the baby oysters on there.
Well, this is very cool stuff. We're going to talk more about how you got to this process, because you didn't grow up thinking you were going to be an oyster farmer. So we'll take you back to your childhood and see how Ryan became an oyster farmer. Ryan Bethay is with me today on The State of Things, and we'll hear more about his journey to becoming an oyster farmer on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Ryan Bethay's oyster business, Oysters Carolina, grows thousands of salty oysters that travel fresh from his farm on Harkers Island to his customers. But while Ryan has become a familiar presence in oyster industry reports and state news features, oyster farming was not his first career stop, and to hear him tell it, it may not be his last. Ryan grew up in Durham, where he loved soccer and was interested in law. That's what captured his attention in his teenage years. So tell us about this, your time growing up. You weren't always interested in oyster farming, right?
I wasn't afraid. So I've always had a proclivity for water. But, originally I wanted to actually work on a garbage truck. So as a kid, when the garbage trucks would come around, I just always was fascinated by that. And so I wanted to be a garbage worker, garbage truck person, sanitation worker, which actually turns out that'd probably be a pretty good job. Now, after that, I really fell in love with dinosaurs, if you can call it that. Which is pretty lame, but, I just loved dinosaurs growing up as well. And then once I got to be a teenager and a little bit older and started kind of seeing things as more of an adult, I thought that law might be something I'd be really interested in. Did that, even went to school. That was why I initially went to school, and even did an internship with people in Guilford County with the assistant district attorney.
Well, let's hear about growing up in Durham. Your dad was an administrator for the city. Tell us about him.
So my dad is someone kind of great probity. So he started out in Forsyth County as a county administrator, then became the assistant city manager in Durham, and then became the interim city manager, and has done so many things for Durham. I think people, a lot of people have just moved here or have only been here, maybe 20 years. A lot of the things that he did are stuff that, there are things that we get to take advantage of now and get to enjoy. I mean, everything from parks to the Durham Bulls being built downtown, police and sanitation, fire, all that stuff. He had his hand in that and was really pivotal in growing Durham to what it is now.
Kind of a high achiever as well, right? In fact, both your parents. How'd your dad meet your mom?
So they met at work. My mom was doing working for the county commissioners for women, and she's always been kind and compassionate and has always been an advocate for families and for women. And her office was actually right across the hallway from my dad, and they were both previously married. And
that's when they were in Winston. They were in Winston at that time, right?
Yeah. Yep. Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We've got a strong Moravian connection in our family. So, if any of the listeners are Moravian, Winston-Salem is a big, big place for that. So, they worked together, did that, and then kind of fell in love as a interracial couple in the 80s in North Carolina. Not a lot of those.
Do you think of serving oysters on a Moravian cookie? Never mind. We'll get to that later. I want to hear more about this marriage.
It's a great idea.
And it's in fact, the perfect hors d'oeuvre, don't you think?
Right.
You mentioned the fact that you're biracial. Your dad is black, mom is white. And when you were growing up, though, I understand you experienced some cognitive dissonance because of what they told you about race, because of the way they wanted you to experience the world, which is kind of what every parent wants for their child. But tell us how that worked for you.
Right. It's complicated. And it, to be honest, Frank, it still is now. Race is something that at times can be very painful. So, wanting to hide racism from your child, I think that's noble. I think that, might even be a good way to do it. The issue is you can only hide it for so long. And then, you're going to have a child who is learning about racism and issues with that at a time in their lives where they're already have kind of a predilection for anger, right? So, I was about 14, 15, 16 years old when I really started to understand, I'm kind of judged by the way I look. That kind of oversimplifies it, but it was something that was really hard for me to go through. And, I guess kind of learning that at that age was tough. And we kind of talked about becoming an attorney and, getting into law. That was kind of when I wanted to do that. So I started seeing that. I started actually being in the court system myself for, what various reasons that I felt like were maybe based on race or maybe based on some other things. And, really seeing that the system can be unfair at times.
Yeah.
And so, that was something that I wanted to do, was get in there and maybe try to affect that. And I think, I think at some point I will end up still doing that. So we'll see.
Well, that's interesting though, growing up, because both your parents were really high achievers, right? Dad in public works, mom teaching and advocacy.
Yep.
So let's try to bring these threads together and talk about how that influenced you. You're getting this story, you're seeing this example of two high-achieving parents that are wanting the best for you, and then you're having this personal experience, both experiencing racism yourself and then seeing how it works on the systemic level, as you say, in teenage when you're already prone to anger. So I want to know kind of how this all came together for you, and just being the child of really high achievers, motivating you, telling you, you can be a lawyer.
Yeah. They did a great job with that. I mean, even still to this day, I think I've got confidence in things that maybe I shouldn't have confidence in. But, once they kind of drill that into you as a kid where, it's somewhat of a platitude, right? You can do anything is what parents what they say good parents tell their kids. Well, my parents told me enough to where I actually believed that. So, it's really shaped kind of who I am now. And it was, especially in Durham too, this experience is just one of one biracial person who's 35 years old in Durham. There's lots of other people out there like me that, live in either the eastern part of the state or live, in the northeast part of the country or the west. And, I think that's kind of important to know that my experience is kind of, even it's a unique experience, but it's probably also somewhat common for a couple other people out there as well.
Sure, sure. And again, another common experience is turbulence in high school. And as you went through high school, it was getting rocky for you, right?
Yeah. You know, my attitude in high school was really, it was just poor. I was fortunate enough to have some athletic success and, to kind of always test well on EOGs and standardized tests. So I was afforded a lot of privilege and opportunities. And, at the time that seemed great. But in reality, that kind of took away from me learning to deal with the adversity that's going to come. You know, everybody's going to have to deal with that at some point. And, I had a bad attitude. I thought it was really cool to be able to do something well without working at it. Mm. And so whether that was, scoring high on a test without studying or having success athletically without practicing or without stretching or training, I thought that's what I thought was cool. And, looking back on that, that's pretty uncool now. Mm-hmm. And, it's something I'm still kind of dealing with that now. But
well, it might be really cool if you could get away with that forever, but eventually, eventually you realize if you can put anything worth doing, probably going to take a little bit of effort. You got expelled,
exactly.
Right? You got expelled your senior year, right?
I did. So, I got expelled. Everything kind of came to a head. Teachers were kind of tired of dealing with me. Definitely administration was. My parents, they didn't know what to do. There wasn't, you couldn't really tell me anything at that stage because of success I was having and kind of doing it the way I wanted to, the cool way. And, getting expelled, I lost a lot of opportunities. I got expelled on a Thursday and I had an official visit to play NC State, play soccer at NC State on that Friday. And, I didn't even show up, didn't call, didn't say, hey, I'm not coming, didn't say, hey, I got expelled. I just didn't show up. And even at the time then, I thought I was too good to play at NC State. So it just was a time in my life that, it's helped me now. My parents always say we raised our kids to be good adults, not to be good kids. And, I think that's good. But I really struggled there for a little bit.
Well, let's see where that struggle took you and how you worked your way back. You started college at UNC Pembroke and then App State. You did begin doing pre-law. So at some point you were focused enough to actually declare pre-law, right?
Yeah. And, it was kind of that same thing again. I was still kind of riding on potential and I was riding on, doing, not studying and not training and things like that and still getting plenty of opportunities. So it was reinforcing the fact to me, hey, I could even get in trouble and then still, not care, still not study, and then still, get awarded an internship, with the district attorney and still, have people saying, oh, you're going to be a great attorney or this would be perfect for you, different things like that. And so I was still kind of in that phase of my life.
Eventually, though, you did decide to take time off from school. What prompted that decision?
Thankfully. a couple things. One, I really kind of started traveling a lot more. And also, once I started paying for school, things really kind of changed. I was broke and, when you actually have to pay for school, then, you kind of prioritize. And I didn't prioritize school. I prioritized money and fun and traveling and experiences. And, I wasn't mature enough then for school anyway. I think that was a huge factor in this whole thing is my maturity was not there. And I think it's hard. When I was teaching, I would tell kids this all the time. I think it's a shame that we're judged so much on our grades between 14 and 18, or kind of what we do in that time period. A lot of our life is set up based on those years.
Right.
And for someone who's really immature, like I am, or like I was and still am now, you know, I had to kind of do things a little bit different than the traditional way.
Yeah. And you made it through. I mean, it's two things. You get judged and all the pathways become narrower and more channeled for you on the outside. And you're internalizing all this stuff and saying, well, I guess I'm good at that and I'm not good at this. Which is a silly thing to have to say about yourself, but of course, quite predictable given the way we educate, our system works.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a lot of hardworking teachers and administrators who do their best, but the system is really not designed to allow a child to come into their full fruit.
But
you did. And so talk about this, because you mentioned teaching, right? So you thought about the oyster business and you got in and you also taught. You were doing both at once, really, setting up the business and teaching. Yep. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So, you know, and if you don't mind, I'd like to share kind of what I kind of had an aha moment to get into teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, kind of in between there, the bartending, you know, the kind of dropping out of school and trying to find myself and traveling. I was bartending at all these different places. And one of the places I was bartending in had these really beautiful wooden floors. And when you would walk on them, they kind of made this, you know, kind of like this tick tock, click clack type noise. And it sounded like, you know, someone who was wearing hard bottom shoes, you know, like someone who's, you know, I guess wearing a suit or something along those lines on the floor. And that sound, for some reason, really kind of got inside of me. And I just thought, you know, I've got to be, you know, this bartending thing is great. I'm making a lot of money. I'm able to travel. But I'm not really making a difference. And, you know, service industry people are very important, but I didn't feel like I was doing anything that was important to help anybody out. So
make a connection, though. I want to hear the rest of the story, but make a connection between that sound and your sense that you weren't doing enough.
You know, it's a sound that I think when people, you know, next time they're walking and they hear that, they'll be able to kind of, oh, okay, I know what he's talking about. But it's a sound of something that somebody in my mind that is making an impact, that is doing things, you know, would make when they're walking because they're, you know, they're in the Capitol building, they're in a courtroom, they're in a hallway, a teaching hallway, or, you know, a school hallway. So that sound is, it's just a sound that we hear all the time, but we might not recognize it. And for some reason at that moment, I recognized it and went home and started figuring out what to do next.
How did you then decide on teaching? Why was that the thing that was going to bring you there?
Well, I kind of thought about it and, you know, thought, okay, maybe this is something that I can look into. And I think if you talk with any of my teachers or anybody that I went to school with, they'd laugh if you said that, you know, this guy's in education now. But you know, I just thought maybe this might be something I could do. I looked into it and found out that in North Carolina, because of our teacher shortage and other reasons, there's a lateral entry program where if you graduate with a certain degree and you get a certain GPA in that degree, then you're eligible to teach while, you know, before you've taken your praxis and kind of while you're doing that. And so it just was, you know, same with the oyster farm. Light goes off. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm excited. This is something that I think I'm going to do. I got on the teacher portal, applied for a job. I got a call from someone who is really important to me now, Dr. Lovett, and then came in for an interview and got the job. Started teaching pretty soon after that.
Science in Franklin County, right?
Yeah, I was teaching science, social studies, and exactly Franklin County, which is about 25, 30 minutes north of Raleigh. I was at a Title I school called Tara Lane. Go Tornadoes, and just had a great set of kids and a great team, and was very supported there. I couldn't have done that. Couldn't have started without them.
Did that experience teach you anything?
Yeah. I think, you know, if you want to learn something either about yourself or about the world, you know, teaching is a good way to do it. It's, you know, when you're standing in front of 30, I was teaching eighth grade. So standing in front of, you know, 30, 14-year-olds, that's exposing. You know, they will expose you.
They know you, don't they? They know you inside. It's their job. The only thing they have to do, wake up, eat, think about exactly how much fun they can have, and know you inside out.
Yep. And that's, you know, and they're really good at that. You know, kids are, I think as we grow up, we lose, you know, a certain sense about, you know, judging and things like that. And these kids, they're, you know, they can tell if you're real or not. They can tell if you care or you don't care. And they can really cut through the BS. And like I said, they will expose you. So I thought that, you know, if this is something I'm going to be doing and it's something I can get exposed at, you know, it's time to kind of cut the crap and be as real as I can.
Talking to Ryan Bethay, who is really an oyster farmer in North Carolina, and we'll talk more about Oysters Carolina and about the challenges he faces every day as we continue our conversation on the state of things. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Ryan Bethay decided in high school he wanted to be an attorney, but after taking a few years off, he found a different passion, oysters. Now he's the owner of Oysters Carolina, a 5-acre farm in Westmouth Bay off Harkers Island. And he can pick out the unique salty flavors from any array of oysters. But the industry does not come without its challenges. Climate change and perhaps pollution could shape how the business runs in the future. Well, let's talk more about oysters and the varieties of them. There's a lot of different kinds of oysters, right? I mean, you can get kind of geeky about the varieties of oysters out there, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. You can definitely get geeky. I know I like to, but you know, just some kind of basic facts. The species of oysters that we grow at Oysters Carolina is called Crassostrea virginicus. So the common name is just the eastern oyster. Now, this is the same oyster that's grown all up and down the East Coast and in the Gulf as well. But, you know, you might notice that if you eat oysters from North Carolina or Virginia or even different regions in North Carolina, they're going to all taste different. And so the way you farm them and the area that they come from, the water they're grown in, the environment they're around, all that stuff affects how the oyster looks and how they taste. And, you know, all those things can be used to grow a really good oyster.
Much difference between farm-grown oysters and wild oysters?
You know, I think that kind of depends. At Oysters Carolina, we do a little bit of both. So we actually take some wild oysters that are dug up. They're called rock oysters. They're what you normally see guys doing when they have the big, you know, 15-foot tongs. They're getting the oysters in the mud. They're bringing them up on their boat. We take those oysters and we put them out on our farm in Westmouth Bay, Harkers Island, and they actually kind of purge themselves, get all that mud out, and then, you know, so you can sell them like that. You know, wild oysters are excellent. Farmed oysters are excellent. And either way, you know, you're supporting folks that live out east, and they're both delicious, I think.
Oh, all my life growing up, I was told that you should only eat oysters in months that have an R in them.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that. What's going on there?
So, you know, with oysters, there's just so much mystique around them, which I think is great. But with that, you know, there's a lot of misinformation. So, you know, that kind of came about. Well, first, let me say that is not true. You can eat oysters every day, 365 days a year. You'd actually probably be a pretty healthy person and also pretty happy, right, if you're eating oysters every day. But ever since modern refrigeration took place, oysters are safe to eat year-round. The reason that they close off the wild season, so the wild season is closed from, you know, let's say April to October, just generally speaking. The reason they do that is because they want to give the oysters time to propagate, and that's kind of a general time. But if you think about it, okay, the oyster doesn't know that we're going to open the season October 15th. So the oyster isn't any different or any less safe October 14th than it is October 15th. And so, you know, you can eat oysters year-round. and they're going to be delicious all year.
And that our stuff was because most of those our months are in the winter months, which is when it was cold, and the I guess the thought was the waters would be colder, and wherever you were to get your oyster, be a little bit colder to get you there. You could probably tell the oyster. Yeah. You could tell the oyster when the season begins because they can't go anywhere. They ain't leaving.
They're sitting there waiting.
Yeah, they ain't leaving. You got statewide accolades now. Tell us more, because the variety is also known as Beaucel. Is that, did I say that right? Because it's got a little French.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yep. Well, yeah. Well, you did a great job with that.
Well, tell us.
Beaucel is just beautiful salt in French. Sorry, Frank.
Beautiful salt. Beautiful salt. I hadn't thought about that. Beaucel.
Yeah.
Well, so tell us more about it, because it won a prize.
It did. We call them Beaucels because the farm that we grow the oysters at is it's one of the saltiest areas in the whole country to grow oysters. And also, too, I think it's important to mention that, you know, when we're talking about a farm, okay, some, you know, people, if you haven't seen a picture of an oyster farm, it's hard to picture it. It's hard to imagine it. So an oyster farm is just like wild oysters, except for instead of them being in the mud, okay, they're in cages about, you know, 18 inches off the bottom. So an oyster farm, even though it has the word farm in it, it's just out in the middle of the ocean. If you have a boat and you are down east, you've probably, you know, driven over top of them. So I think that's important for folks to know. With the Beaucels, what we do is we have two types of oysters. We have native sons, which come from the Newport River first. They get very big and plump, but they're not as high salinity, which is something that I really enjoy in an oyster. So we take them from the Newport River and we put them at Harker's Island, and they get really, really salty. The Beaucels are actually grown in Harker's Island full time. So they're smaller, boutique, a little bit more delicate. And we recommend those for eating raw. And then the native sons, which I mentioned earlier, that are kind of bigger, plump, they come from the low salinity area. We put them at Harker's Island and it salts them up. Even within about 6 hours, Frank, it's amazing. We leave them out there for longer than that, but within 6 hours, the whole taste of the oyster changes. And we recommend those, again, the native sons, for roasting or steaming or putting in stews or, you know, anything you'd want a big, fat oyster for.
You mentioned earlier that how the wind and tide affect your work, obviously at the mercy of the weather. What about hurricanes? How does that affect your business?
Yeah, so hurricanes affect... I'm going to kind of talk about it in a general sense. They affect oyster farms and the oyster industry in several ways. So, you know, the first thing is, you know, a huge inundation of fresh water. So oysters are pretty resilient animals. They live in a, you know, a salinity range of anywhere from 10 to 28 parts per thousand. To give you an idea, the ocean is 33 to 35 parts per thousand salt. So they have a pretty wide range, but what they aren't very good at is going from, let's say, 28 parts per thousand down to 10 parts per thousand in, you know, a matter of days, which is what happens when you have, you know, heavy rainfall and then flooding.
All that fresh water, yeah.
Yep, yep, yep. And then another thing is, just in terms of pure business, when we have large events like that, the state has to shut everything down. And they do this for a couple reasons. One, they do it because we're going to get heavy rainfall, and so they use an algorithm to decide whether the waters are safe. So if there's a certain number of inches of rain that fall in a 24-hour period in an area, they shut it down. The other thing is when we have these big hurricanes, you know, the state has to shut down. So they can't go out there and they can't monitor what we're doing. And we're dealing with live animals here. So it's highly regulated. And there's a lot of people checking up on us to make sure that what we're doing is safe, which it is. And so, you know, people can feel good about the fact that if the state can't monitor it, they're going to shut it all down. And, so nothing's going to be out there that's going to be unsafe.
But it does bring to mind, I mean, you said earlier that under normal conditions, your biggest worry in terms of pollution is wild animal waste. But in a hurricane, we have hog lagoons that spill, and that gets into that waste gets into the water. Is that a concern for you? And does that sometimes contaminate?
It is. It is. And you know, everything, you know, when we talk about this, we're kind of talking about generalizations, but in the oyster industry, the term site-specific is something that comes up a lot, and that just means where specifically your farm is, the issues you deal with. And a lot of these things are site specific. So if you're, you know, in a certain county that has a lot of hogs, you know, hog farm waste is going to be something you deal with. For us, it's the wild animal coliform that that we deal with. But other than that, we don't have a lot of we don't have that issue a lot. Also, too, something that's really unique about our farm is it takes 4.5 inches of rainfall in a 24-hour period to shut us down. So that's a pretty substantial amount. A normal oyster farm would be maybe 1.5 inches. And the reason I say that is because it takes so much rain to shut us down because we have so much ocean water flowing through there. So we're on the north side of Harkers Island. To our east is Cape Lookout, so the inlet there. And then to our west is the inlet that goes in between Shackelford Banks and Beaufort, so or in Moorhead City. So we have water, a lot of fresh ocean water coming from both sides that really just moves anything that would be bad. It moves it out very, very quickly. And, you know, we're saying all this, and this sounds great, and this is wonderful, but dealing with such high salinity waters and with waters with so much action, wave action and wind and all this other stuff is makes our oysters a lot harder to actually grow. So it's harder on our end, but it makes, you know, our stuff is safe.
Well, and when you talked about the state shutting you down, what does that mean? You can't harvest them, or do you have to get rid of everything you have?
No. Yeah, it just means you can't harvest them.
In that period.
So what they do, exactly. So what they do is they, and this is, you know, this is good for everybody to know. What they do, again, they use the algorithm to shut people down. And then to open them back up, they actually go out and test themselves. So you can imagine, we have 330 miles of coastline in our state. To open up, if any of that gets shut down, to open it up, somebody actually has to go out on a boat and take a sample. So extremely labor intensive. And,
does the state test for, or does anybody, are the oysters tested for coliform? How do we, cause you talked about the amount of regulation that you have to.
So they just test the water. They test the water for it. And if that comes back, then they still give it a 24-hour period to make double sure. And then they open it up the following day.
Well, talk about sustainability. You do all of your harvesting on a kayak, right? You don't even want a gasoline engine on your waterways.
Yeah. So we used to do that a lot more. And especially getting started, that was something that I enjoyed doing. We're, you know, now we bring the skiff out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
One of the gentlemen that works for us, Phil, he takes the kayak out. We've kind of also done something with a sneak boat, which is like a duck hunting boat. And we kind of rigged it up and put a trolling motor on there. So to keep, again, you know, no gasoline. And we used that for a while. And we just, that whole thing kind of started because, you know, once we won the Oyster of the Year, and once we kind of realized what we had out there with the oysters, we just wanted to do right by them. So that's why we harvest the same day, or we deliver the same day that we harvest. We do all these things because we're, you know, where we grow the oysters is so great that we just kind of want to do right by them.
You know, you mentioned earlier that you're in a place that isn't as affected by industrial runoff or industrial contaminants as farther south. But what about climate change? Is that having an impact on you?
Yeah. And, you know, and also too, Frank, you know, down south, they're growing really good oysters. There's a lot of guys down there that grow amazing stuff. So with climate change, you know, with, I guess the best way to talk about it is warming of the oceans. So if the oceans get warmer, right, there's going to be less dissolved oxygen in the water where we're at. And oysters, you know, they're not very complicated animals, but they have gills. And it's probably the most important thing to their anatomy. So they need dissolved oxygen. That warm water also creates more powerful storms. So, you know, for infrastructure damage and things like that, then wetter storms. So for flooding, and then also the sheer number of storms that we see. So climate change really hits us. And then when you talk about ocean acidification, which is just the ocean's pH changing due to all the carbon dioxide that sinks into it. You know, a lot of people think that the carbon dioxide goes up in the air and it goes up in the ozone and it creates holes, and it does, but actually most carbon dioxide falls down and is absorbed by the ocean. So when that happens, the pH level in the ocean changes. Well, shellfish, so anything, you know, bivalves and crustaceans and things like that that use calcium carbonate and use other things like that, or calcium carbonate, to grow their shells, that really affects them. So they can't grow the shell as well. The shells are more brittle, and there's a lot more mortality when that happens.
Well, so climate change is one of the challenges you're facing. What about the coronavirus pandemic? How has that changed your work, or has it?
Yeah, it definitely has. You know, I think everybody out there can say that. You know, for us, we were a little bit luckier, because when I started this, the goal was to deliver fresh seafood to people in North Carolina. We wanted North Carolinians to have access to North Carolina seafood. So we've been delivering direct to people, free delivery, by the way, direct to people since the beginning. So we didn't really have to kind of pivot to a delivery model. But having said that, we work with one restaurant. That restaurant is kind of closing until early November to do some remodeling. So that was a big chunk of sales. And then we get a lot of revenue from doing big events. So really any event. So we'll do anything from stuff maybe in your listening area, like at Motorco. We'll do like an oyster roast at Motorco, to really big events down in Charlotte at breweries, where we'll go through 5,200 oysters in 4 or 5 hours. Mm. And, you know, with social distancing and with, you know, numbers of people being limited, which it should be, you know, those events are gone. So lots of our revenue is kind of being, kind of chipped away at. But I think it's going to be important to be poised for whenever we get back to being able to do stuff like that.
I don't have too much time for this last question, but obviously after George Floyd's death, a lot of companies were taking anti-racist actions. Is that something you see happening in the oyster industry?
Huh. That's a great question. Action is a word that can mean a lot of things, right? Action could be posting doing the Blackout Tuesday thing where they posted something on Instagram. I think most industries, the industries that are taking kind of a leadership role in race, also have minorities within them. And the oyster industry doesn't necessarily have that. There's not very many minorities in there. And so I wouldn't say it's a priority of the industry. But I will say this, that the USDA and other entities like that have done a good job in putting things in place for women farmers and minority farmers that want to get started. So if anybody's listening that wants to get started in that, there's definitely programs put in place to help mitigate some of the issues that you might run into.
Ryan Bethea is the owner and operator of Oysters Carolina. Ryan, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us.
I had a great time, Frank. Thanks for having me.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.